Good afternoon and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm your host, Dan Eastman, and today is Wednesday, October 4th, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Eastman Financial Report. We appreciate your viewership. We appreciate you watching and supporting WVW-TV. We're happy to be able to bring you news and information that is certainly outside of the mainstream, but is very, very important in the marketplace of ideas for giving you alternative viewpoints and alternative thought so that you can better assess the world in which we live. So thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate your viewership. Of course, you know that this is not a commercial network, it's a sponsored network, and kind viewers and donors such as yourself, we thank you so much for supporting the foundation and keeping this broadcast medium free without a paywall or without a subscription. We're happy to be on air talking about these issues free for all, access for all. So thank you very much for your support. I'd like to also thank my sponsor, Swiss America Trading, who is a great supporter of WVW-TV. And of course, they are, as I like to say, fine purveyors of precious metals. They make a market in silver and gold coins and platinum coins and different types of tangible precious metals. So if you're interested at all in looking at tangible precious metals to add to your portfolio, you can give them a call at 1-800-519-6271. Ask them for some free information, or you can go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, and if you use the promo code Eastman for Eastman Financial Report, they'll send you free information, and you can also shop around on their site and see what they have to offer. I would like to mention that they are still offering the special on the silver walking half dollars. They're offering them today for $13.50, including shipping, and that's a great deal because you're not having to pay to have the product shipped to you, and it's a really good price for half for silver half dollar bullion coins. So go to the website, check it out, use the promo code Eastman, and I'm sure they'll be more than happy to assist you with your precious metal needs. Well, let's jump into the news today. And of course, what a day, what a difference a day makes, as the old saying goes. We have been here 24 hours and we wake up today to find out that the Speaker of the House of Representatives was shown the door. And that's kind of an interesting thing from a political perspective, but this is not a political show, it's a financial show, and we want to think about what does this mean for the average American. I mean, do we really care if the Speaker of the, you know, the House of Representatives is replaced? And the question, the bigger question, is what does this signal to the global markets? And unfortunately, as you can imagine, when you change leadership in a rather unconventional way, or a very, very, very small minority of Republican representatives vote with the Democrats to boot out McCarthy, it sends a message of instability to the global markets. And of course, we saw the reaction in the stock market and the bond market. And that's, you know, it's markets do not like uncertainty, even though every day there's uncertainty in the market. But this certainly doesn't help. And whether you fall on the side of the conservative faction in the House of Representatives, who's really, really trying to bring some fiscal responsibility to Washington, and then you have the more mainstream Republican faction who just is perfectly happy to go along and keep spending us broke. That's the situation that we're in. And I think there's a very interesting historical parallels throughout American history. If you think about how the country was founded originally, we were a colonial place that really, you know, we were colonies, and the governance of our world happened at the local level through, at least in New England, through the congregational system of church and government was the same. It was the same group. And effectively, they were Bible-based governance and in these Puritan communities all across New England. And in the Middle Atlantic states, that was a little bit different. And then, of course, in the South, in the House of Burgesses, of course, in Virginia, there was a bit more democracy going on. But at the end of the day, it was a colonial system based upon what was happening in London, and the governance happened in London. Of course, that was the big issue. Taxation without representation led to the American Revolution, in part. And as a result of that, the factions that came together during the excitement and enthusiasm of the American Revolution, which took 8 years, basically was a unifying force in the colonies to become free and independent states. And they had to figure out how, I talked about this yesterday, how do you put these free and independent states together in some sort of a union that allows for mutual protection and mutual services for, you know, a standing army for defense and a navy and, of course, running the post office and dealing, you know, with international issues and, of course, Indian and Native American issues as well. That's how our federal government came to be. But at the time, and if you remember George Washington, I don't remember George Washington, I'm not quite that old, but in his farewell address and in other communication, he warned specifically about political parties, because in England there were vicious wars between political parties. And if you looked at what was happening in Parliament, and of course the colonists, now free Americans, would look to England and watch the chaos in the British Parliament. George Washington warned, said, don't get into these political parties things. Keep your government small. People should go as representatives. Keep it small. Keep it under control. Do whatever business needs to be done. And operate under a balanced budget and then go back home. And of course, we think about how George Washington, the very famous painting, after he served two terms as president, he yields the sword of power and goes back to his farm. And this, you know, and that was the idea, that, you know, government was supposed to be something you did as service, like serving on your church or synagogue council, and you do it and then you served your time, you know, and then you go back to, you know, enjoying your life, versus becoming a career path to great wealth. And that's unfortunately where we find ourselves in the American phenomenon today. So instead of taking George Washington's sage advice and avoiding political parties, we immediately began to focus on the Whigs, which were the Federalists, and they were up in the New England and northern areas. And of course, the Democratic Party, which was the little guys, the farmers and the, you know, the merchants and the small people, because they were much more interested in the democratic process. And that was basically Andrew Jackson. And as the country emerged into, you know, the United States of America, we had the Democrats, which were very conservative people, small town, small government, anti-bank. They didn't want banks. They wanted solid silver money, gold money. These are the most conservative people in the country. And the more progressive were the Whigs and Federalists, who wanted a bigger government, a central bank. We wanted to replicate what we had in England and make government bigger and more and stronger and more important. Of course, when you think about the Federalist Papers as they were being written as, you know, selling tools or briefs or propaganda, basically, to create and to solidify a new federal government. The Whig Party was very powerful, and the Democratic Party was very powerful, and this faction has existed in American politics. Well, the Whig Party basically saw nothing wrong with slavery at all. I mean, this was all about making money, you know. And the abolitionists, basically out of Boston and then other places, really were having a difficult time reconciling the great American opportunity and freedoms with this idea that certain Americans were held in slavery and everybody else was out there, you know, in the great adventure, moving west, making money. And this abolitionist movement, of course, picked up steam in the middle of the 1800s, which ultimately culminated in the Civil War. And of course, the Whig Party was breathing its last gasps as the people who were traditionally in the Whig Party were starting to look at a different way. The Democratic Party was very much in the agricultural sector, very embedded in the Deep South with their slavery operations. I mean, this was basically the mechanism used, the political mechanism used to control and protect the institutions of slavery. The Democratic Party is the doctrine of unclean hands in the law, is they have very unclean hands. Okay, this came from a political system that was hell-bent on keeping slavery in place for economic reasons. And the Republicans in the North emerged out of the Whig Party. And there's a bit of a debate between New Hampshire and Wisconsin as to where the birthplace of the Republican Party actually happened. And both states have a pretty good claim. But what it tells you is the Whig Party was coming unhinged, and it was breaking into a new faction. and that new faction became the Republican Party. It was decidedly anti-slavery, and they were very business driven because it was basically the same people who were making money through industry, manufacturing, and shipping. All the northern economics was embedded in the Republican Party. And of course, that's where they get the term, you know, the country club Republicans. Well, that came later. But the point is, and the point I'm trying to make is, you're seeing still this problem with the Republican Party splitting into very conservative people who absolutely cannot imagine $33 trillion in debt, $2 trillion annual deficits, spending money like crazy. And then you have the more establishment Republicans who see nothing wrong with this because they know in the long run, there's, you know, everything's in equilibrium according to Adam Smith, and the long run is past their natural life. So they don't care. They just don't care. So what you're ending up seeing is yet another split in this faction of Americans. And the interesting thing is, you'd like to think the Democratic Party is all about conservatism. Well, at the end of the day, when the Republicans freed the slaves in the Civil War, and you know, the Republicans won the Civil War, kept the country together, and the South was vanquished, and the Democratic Party became very, very influential in the Reconstruction of the South. And you know, it was a very, very conservative place to be right up until the 1930s, when basically FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, figured out that if you take the progressive movements, which were breaking off of the Republicans in the Midwest, and you turn the value of the Democratic Party to a progressive party, then you can control a whole lot of space. You had the rock solid Democrat South, and you had the labor Democrats, and you suddenly build a coalition around liberal social progressive ideas. And at that point, the Democratic Party is what is started to become what it is today, which is this rapidly progressive party that is hell-bent on driving off a cliff. And the Republican Party is now reactionary. And that's why we're seeing, when you know, kick out the speaker, this suggests that there's going to be some real bumpy roads in America, because the progressives have become so progressive and the conservatives have been left behind. There's no conservative Democratic Party in the South, and there's no conservative Republican Party in the North. So you got this increasing number of American people that are saying, you know what, this isn't working for us, and there's no political party representing us. So this is starting to create a political void. And the reason I bring this up, this is not a political show, it's a financial show, but this has ramifications in the global markets. And you know, one of the lead stories today, I talked about the 30-year bonds, federal treasury bonds. Is there Janet Yellen selling out these bonds, 30-year money? You know, and they were up very high. They were, you know, in almost 5%. And now we see the 10-year notes, top rate, 4.8%. That's the highest the 10 years have been since 2007, which, of course, was the beginning of the last financial crisis. So what you're seeing is the 30-year treasuries, the 10-year treasuries are starting to trade at very high interest rates. Okay, when the government issues it, the price of the bond falls, it's algebraic, and the effective rate of the bond is bumping up. So, you know, while Janet gets her $1,000 per bond, you know, what does she care? They are immediately discounted in the market. So if you bought it at $1,000, you know, all of a sudden, you know, in a day or two, and the bond market's been getting slammed, your $1,000 is worth $980 or whatever the math is. So you're taking a capital hit, and unless you hold it until maturity, you're going to take a loss, and the loss is that increase in interest rate. And this is starting to happen, you know, globally, as people are buying federal instruments. And this is, there's a prevalent in every mutual fund, in every pension fund, in every 401k, in every IRA. Whenever you have aggregated money that's managed by professionals, the go-to safety vehicle, of course, is federal debt, because the theory is that the federal government will never default on its debt. And we've seen that very recently. We saw it in March. We just saw it, you know, like last, what is it, last over the weekend. The federal government is not in a position to default on its debt or default on its obligations. But the market is saying it's getting to be too crazy. And of course, we were talking yesterday about the 33 trillion. I used to say 32 trillion. Now I say 33. What's a trillion, right? The point is, as you're looking at this debt increasing and you're looking at a federal spend, I don't even want to say the word budget. It's not a budget. It's a federal appropriation. And, you know, some experts are predicting $2 trillion in deficit. I kind of, you know, flip the coin. Who knows? 1.5, somewhere between 1.5 and $2 trillion in deficit this year, adding to the federal debt, it's starting to have a global impact on the United States. And then when you kick out the Republican leader, basically, and I don't want to say the word coup, it's, you know, the word is overused, but, you know, certainly a strategic sandbagging of the speaker. And now, of course, we'll see who emerges. And of course, that will set the tone for going into the election. And of course, all the pundits are out. This is the greatest thing that ever happened or the worst thing that ever happened. You know, these are the best of times and the worst of times, is the great author Charles Dickens wrote. And maybe they are. Maybe every time is the best and the worst. But I think these are certainly interesting times. The old Chinese proverb, you know, may you live in interesting times. Well, you know, that's what 6,000 years of perspective will generate. So we watch this and we see what happens. And, you know, we have up until November 17th. Remember, they passed the continuing resolution to November 17th. So now we're going to have a new speaker. And of course, the conservative faction will want, you know, pound the table and cut that spending and bring this back. And whoever gets elected is probably going to have to be more aggressive in that, in those endeavors, which will, of course, create problems on the Democrat side. So, and of course, in the White House. So we'll have to just watch and see what happens. But that's why when you watch these financial programs, you want to be thinking critically. And I think that was the full purpose of this, I say lecture series, but it's really, you know, the financial Eastman Financial Report. The idea is I want you to think about what you're seeing in a bigger picture. It's a matrix. It's a system. And when you start seeing these things, then your question, at least if you're interested in self-preservation and self-financial preservation, is how do you take that information and start to use it to your benefit, or at least for your protection, so that as these economic storms blow through, you're not the victim. You're not the one, you know, left at the side of the road. You want to be in a position where you're thinking strategically and thinking about how do you position yourself to ride out the storm. And it's starting to happen now. Another story I wanted to talk about, check my time here, is that there's a story about the mortgage bonds today. And let me explain that mortgage bonds. Okay. As I had mentioned in earlier lectures, the way housing is financed in America, and I'm talking about single family housing, maybe duplexes, maybe four families, because there are programs. But if you want to buy a home, you don't want to rent an apartment, you want to buy a home, whether it's a freestanding home or a condominium or side by side, whatever. If you want to go and get yourself a mortgage and buy a home, it's very standardized throughout the United States. It doesn't really matter which state you live in. Now, there are different real estate rules and regulations. But at the end of the day, when you go and apply for a mortgage, it's very standard. They have standardized underwriting. You need a certain amount of money down. If you don't have 20% down, you need mortgage insurance. And you have to do this and you have to do that. And it's called the underwriting process. And if you check all the boxes, you have all the information and your down payment's legitimate and everything, they will give you a mortgage. And then when you go to do the mortgage closing, used to be you'd go to an office somewhere. Now it's all online. You just click the little box. But what you're doing is you're signing a very standardized set of documents. And in a home mortgage, there's two documents. There's the note, which is the IOU that you sign. I hereby promise to pay, you know, $500,000 plus interest over 30 years. And you sign that note. That's your commitment. And then there's a mortgage document, which is in effect a lien against the property. Now, there's two kinds of states in the United States. One is a lien theory, like Wisconsin. If I buy a house, I get title to the house and the bank has a lien on it until I pay off that note, the second document. There's a note and there's a mortgage. The mortgage is a lien. In the title theory states, like I think Arizona and places in the South, The title company holds the deed, and they don't give you the deed until you pay off your mortgage. Okay, and it's paid in full, you get the deed. So in those states, the vast majority of people who have all people who have a mortgage, they don't own anything. They have a future right to be given a warranty deed once that mortgage is paid off. So a lot of people can go through their entire life if you have a mortgage balance and you don't own it. Well, I bought a house, I own a home. No, you don't. The trust company owns the home until you pay off the mortgage. And if you don't pay it off and you just keep rolling from one house to the next and you're always having a mortgage, you don't own anything. Okay, the bank owns it, and you know the obligation is you're the beneficiary of that trust, and they will convey title by contract at that price, you know, when you've paid off the note. So the point is, all of these mortgage documents, whether it's a title theory state or a lien theory state, they're all standardized. They're all the same. And after the 2007 and 08 blowout with the liar loans, or people lied and they got these giant mortgages, they didn't have the income, that it's very standardized. And the reason that is because in the olden days, banks would take the money out of their vault and they would give it to you and you'd buy the house and then you'd pay the bank back. And the, you know, that was the banking business. Too risky. And the banks don't want to hold a lot of mortgages in the vault. They're vault mortgages. So what they do is they take those notes, okay, that you signed. Those are negotiable instruments. And if you bundle those all together from all around the country, all different neighborhoods and all different places, and you put it into a gigantic pool that's funded by Wall Street, and they do that by issuing bonds into the market, raise the money, and then they buy these giant pools of mortgages. Those are called syndicated mortgages. And the vast majority of people who buy homes are using syndicated mortgages. Now, we remember the bank failure. I think it was First Republic. Make sure I get the right name. The bank that failed that was making all these wonderful loans to the rich people who would buy homes. Well, they would keep those in the vault. And that's where they got caught. But the vast majority of banks, they don't want to hold that. They want to sell it into these syndications and then buy the bonds back. And then you're sitting there with a grossly diversified portfolio of mortgages, and you don't have the risk of any one person defaulting. And that's why the banks blew out in 2007 and 08, is because these bonds, which are valued and marked to market daily based upon fluctuating interest rates and everything, suddenly looked like they were at risk. The value went to zero, and it triggered the nightmare of 07 and 08. Well, today, the interesting story, it's a long lead-in, but this is sort of a lecture series, is that these bond holders, the people who are buying these mortgage bonds, and these are banks, insurance companies, pension funds, 401ks, all the institutional money buys these. And what they're saying is, the interest rates aren't high enough for the risk we're taking because the American consumer is really getting squeezed with student loans and higher gas prices, higher food prices. And we're going to start to see the same defaults we saw in 2007, 2008, which wiped out Lehman Brothers and wiped out Bear Stearns and wiped out the banking system and brought in quantitative easing. We're starting to see a deterioration in the quality of these bonds. So we want a higher interest rate. And they're pushing towards 8%. And of course, when you're a bank and all they do is originate mortgages and they bundle them up and sell them off to the syndicators, and the syndicators are saying, we don't like 7 anymore. We like to see 8. Then what happens is the mortgage rates keep going up. And this has nothing to do with the Federal Reserve over here screwing around, oh, we're going to raise the interest rates a quarter. The market is speaking. And keep in mind, if you think about Adam Smith and in the long run, everything goes into equilibrium, and you think about that national income ball of all the businesses and all the interest, the real economy is saying, notwithstanding the Federal Reserve's tweaking, we need 8%. And it's trickling down in. So now you're ending up, you're seeing stories like virtually 100% of Americans can't afford to buy a house because the housing prices are way too high. And if you look at the housing prices being too high and 7.88 or 8% mortgage rates, the number of people, remember my three silos, you get the poor people, the middle class people, and the rich people. Well, the rich people already own lots and lots of real estate. You know, they might be bottom fishing around for a bargain. the middle class is sitting here with their eyes bulging out thinking, this is a real problem because I can't sell the house I have at 3.6% average interest to go to an 8%. We can't do it because student loans just kicked in and the gas is too high and, you know, food prices are too high. And of course, the poor people are sitting here just watching the ship. It's like standing on the dock. It's the last ship leaving town and you're not on it, you know. And this is where we have a political problem that's happening, notwithstanding the poor little Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve over here tweaking around, okay, let's raise the interest rates another quarter. At some point, the giant ball of the economy is going to do what it does. And I think we're seeing fiscal policy has basically run its course at this point, and or monetary policy, excuse me, the monetary policy tools, the only thing they can do is dramatically slice the interest rates and hope that the giant ball economy starts to follow. But when you're looking at $33 trillion in debt, and you're looking at $2 trillion a year deficit, and you're looking at the House of Representatives of the United States basically booting a guy out, first time in history, in recent history, where somebody's been shown the door in less than a year, the great ball of the global economy is aware, because this is where the smart people are. This is the real economy. And the fiscal policies of the United States and the monetary policies of the Federal Reserve, they can only do so much. And I think you're seeing that in spades when you start seeing mortgage bonds, because the bankers that hold the mortgage bonds today don't want to be like the bankers of 2007 or 2008. They want to be a lot smarter than that. They're saying, we're not taking that risk. We're not going to be holding rates low until all of a sudden everything falls off a cliff and then we're going to get burned and get wiped out. They're covering their risk profile today, which is prudent business, because they're operating in this big ball of the real economy, and they're saying, you know, we're seeing too much crazy out of the government. We need bigger yields. Well, unfortunately, you know, whichever silo you're in, and I think this tends to really whack the middle class silo the hardest. This is what's happening with this type of public policy. So, you can see that. Another story I wanted to briefly mention is the West Texas Intermediate, our dear friend, the oil price from the beautiful crude coming out of Midland and Odessa, Texas. West Texas, it's a sweet, light crude oil that refines very nicely, and it's very easy and good. And, you know, they just ship it east and refine it, and then it becomes gasoline. What we're seeing is the price of that. Remember I was talking West Texas was bumping 100 in the 90s? Well, it's coming down, because what we see in the numbers is the demand for gasoline is declining. And what that tells you is when the middle class and the poor are squeezed, you have to think about ways to stretch your dollar. And one way is to take the bus, ride a bike, walk, don't go anywhere, stop, you know, plan your trip so you can hit three or four places in one round. It's telling you that aggregate demand is still suffering. We see student loans kicking in, and you see high food prices, and you're starting to see people use less gasoline. It's not because they're going out and buying cars that get better mileage. You're stuck with your car. As a matter of fact, the car industry is somewhat in turmoil as well. So it's another indicator that while, you know, I guess, well, Nero fiddled, Rome burned or something, well, we're sort of at a point where we need to be asking our government for better performance and responsibility. Another interesting number that came out I thought was interesting is the factory orders have surged, which is good. Hey, the economy is on fire. You know, but then when you look, it's 19% increase in war production. And of course, where's that going? We're not at war in Cincinnati. Okay, we're at war in Ukraine or wherever else. We're effectively running a machine that is, and that isn't stuff we're selling overseas. That's stuff the government is buying and giving away overseas. So it's government stimulation of production. It's almost like a war economy, kind of an interesting time. Well, anyway, we'll talk about stagflation and some of the other big issues tomorrow. But thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate your viewership at WVW TV. Thanks so much for your support. Give our sponsors a consideration. And have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.